comforter and maybe ask the first question. And that question is that one of the things we heard from the social science, critical science speakers today was that the data that is being collected from polls and that the results, well, the data first is inadequate, and secondly, the results that the inadequate data has generated has, with even with all the caveats and the issue of uncertainty attached to them, have to be suspect. So what I would like to ask is that so we continue to have this severe problem of getting the right data, processing it in the right way, and presenting it. So the whole issue of communication continues to be a severe problem. I guess what I would like to ask is, it seems to me that what we need here is more of a team approach between what I would call the technical community and the social, political science, soft science, if you wish, community, in crafting a mechanism by which you get the kind of data you really want. And I think it takes both sides to do that, and see if we can somehow make progress in this very, very important area. And I think one of the problems is we not only have a severe problem of communicating the risks and the issues associated with nuclear waste to the public, we have a severe problem of communicating from within. I guess I would go to maybe Mike to get it started and ask, how do we get your community of experts that are very critical to this whole process to better interact with the technical community in formulating a strategy that has a greater hope of success than we've had in the past? And any member here is welcome to comment, but I think I'd like to yield to the social science perspective first.
You know, I'm a firm believer in what I said, which is that asking questions and listening to people and finding out what they're really interested in is a science. And heretofore, at least in this area, I don't believe it has been treated as such for the various reasons that I gave. So, first of all, I think we want to give gathering this information as much respect as we give engineering information and economic data as well as health data. So I think it has to be taken seriously. I totally agree that in fact this is something that should not be left to an exercise solely of people with degrees in geography and economics and other areas of social science. This is an area in which I think you must start out with good research questions. What are the key public-related questions that we want to have answered? And I don't think that those are going to come necessarily all for me. They're going to come from a wide variety of people who have wide interests in this field, and that means you need a debate as to what is it you want to find out from the public, what locations do we want to have the questions asked. Is it, in my case, I've focused on those locations at the existing defense nuclear weapons sites because I have a feeling that those are places where things are going to occur. But maybe we need to do some sampling around some other places where there are a lot of civilian sites. And maybe at the same time, we also need to take some samples of the American public in general that has never been done in this area. The only place that's been done a little bit with that some of the chemical weapons sites. And maybe I had a little something to do with that, and that's why it occurred. But so I think the first thing is we need to treat this very seriously and get together experts both in the science of sampling and in the science that really governs the technological issues and policy issues to think through what are the right questions to ask. And then I think we need to again, scientifically move it forward, write out the questions, debrief the questions, pilot test it until it was comfortable. And then once we have the questions that we want to ask, then we have to make a commitment to do it not just once, 1 year. So if you're going to spend this much money, you'd be nuts to do it just once. This is something that it's this important. We want to do this the way the government does in Haines, or the way Gallup polls to see which candidates happen to be popular every year, or which policy issues are popular. This is a thing that you want to keep up. This problem is going to go on for decades, so why don't we treat it as such? Again, treat it with the respect that it deserves. So I think I'll stop there and turn it over to others for comments.
All right, I'd like to give the technical perspective to either David or Bob.
Can you talk in? Bob? No. Naturally, I had a reaction to Mike Greenberg's comment, which is a little bit of history. It's okay. What? It is a little bit of history. I went to Washington in 2002 to help Margaret Chu, who was the director of the Economic Project, set up a science and technology program that was supposed to last for 5 or 10 or 20 years. And Mark Peters came right behind me, and Tom Cotton behind him was right there helping us out. And a question that came up within a week of the first discussions was, should this science and technology effort have a social science component? Should there be social science intellectual work that should be supported in order to supplement and complement the work that was going to be done in engineering and in science to advance our knowledge of the whole Yucatan situation? And in order to advance that, I convened over the course of about a month or two the names of 7 or 8 or 9 or 10 social scientists who had worked in this business for a while, and we had a series of conference calls with them. I'm sure that Tom Cotton sat in on some of them, and I think Mark did too. We had people like Todd LaPorte and Howard Kernwood and Gene Rosa and 6 or 8 others, Paul Slover, people who had been thinking about these issues and had their background in different ways. And we came up with at least the semblance of a bunch of ideas that might, were they distilled and reviewed and so on, become a nucleus for a social science component that could do a meeting or two a year. After all, our budget was to be 20 or 30, and which we ended up with 25 years later. And would supplement and complement the science and technology group. And having put that all together, I brought it to Margaret Church, she's the director of the Economic Project. And we had a couple of discussions after which she ended up naming it, just telling it right there at the embryo stage. And the reason was, she couldn't see a single thing that we would undertake that wouldn't have the appearance, were we to support it, of looking to the cynics as a manipulation. That is, the Yucca Mountain Project is doing this work to manipulate public opinion. It seemed to her, and she was right, I couldn't see a single topic that couldn't be so construed by people who were maliciously trying to say that that's what we were doing, even though we were open-minded about it, and we had some of the very best people, and it was, in fact, in the end, would be a competitive process in which we'd get, 79 proposals, and a peer group would pick the top 7 or 10. And although it wasn't so, it just got killed on that basis. And I remember going around to talk to others in the department to find out whether or not that perspective of Margaret's was the prevailing view of the department, and everybody agreed. I'm telling you, in my view, it hasn't changed since 2000. This was by then early 2003. But 5 years later, it hasn't changed at all, and the department is not going to support that. Not because, by the way, we had goodwill to try to do something that's intellectually important, and it would last for 3 or 5 years, or who knew about it. At least I did, and I know Margaret Chu. Even that goodwill may have vanished, I don't know. But even if it were to be reestablished at that level, there's no way on earth that's going to prevail in the political process in which the department is so sensitive to the accusation of manipulation. And that's a real, real problem. Who's going to support this?
And maybe a couple more comments, one for David and one for Jeff.
Let me just put one idea on the table, maybe how it could be done, and how some aspects of this that otherwise would be difficult could be done. If we think about the analog of the Transportation Research Board as an established element of the national academies, so that it is truly independent, and a national academy's independent element like that, that can play these sorts of roles. I spoke with that Abbott's an idea.
One thing that really hits me is the fact that a little epidemiology I do every time I travel tells me that the people who were asking to give their views know almost nothing. I ask, the first question I always ask is what percentage of the fuel rod that goes into a power reactor is still there when it comes out. And I usually, you know, people miss that by about, you know, you can imagine, I get, you know, 60%, 40%. And nobody knows anything about the things we're talking about. And it strikes me as interesting that I was talking today about informed consent. You can't have consent that is not in any way, shape, or form by data. People don't know what it is we're talking about. But one way to deal with the question that Bob just raised to me would be to set up at least some studies to try to figure out what it is that people do and do not know, so that my level of ideology can be supported or refuted by something. There is no understanding out there about what it is that we're talking about. I think that the most interesting thing that comes out of the stuff that Mike has done is that where people have been close enough to these issues to have had some interest in them so they know something, it looks as if by virtue of people knowing something more, they seem to be sort of somewhat more supportive. Otherwise, you can't draw much more into it than that. The people that could press on with organizing it actually tested were people who had some idea about the relationship between, in many cases, what they knew, what their neighbors knew about what was going on at the Savannah Riverside or at Hanford, and its relationship to other related issues. I think that the fundamental question here is how the country can get itself in a position that people know as much about this issue as they do about most issues, because I think they know a heck of a lot more about most things that they're being asked opinions of than they do about anything related to the issues that we're talking about. And if we think they're as fundamental as that, then some effort ought also to be directed to the question of how in the world anyone's going to learn anything about what it is that we're talking about.
Mike?
I just wanted to add two brief comments for it. I focused today on surveys because I think that was what I was supposed to do. But I also want to add that if we're going to take this seriously in terms of having a social science component, we need to address two other issues. One, Bill started addressing, but he addressed in the long run. I'll address them in the much shorter run, which is the issue is what are the economic impacts of not only Yucca Mountain. I think much too much of the discussion, including what Bob said, is focused around Yucca Mountain. My surveys haven't looked at Yucca Mountain. I'm thinking about the 64 locations that have nuclear power plants, the many facilities that have waste facilities. There's a lot of facilities out there. But I think we also want to give people a sense of what is the economic impact of having such a facility in your area versus closing down such a facility, not to terrify them, not to bias them, but again, that can be done scientifically. We have reasonably sophisticated economic simulation models, some of which I've used for CREST on the nuclear weapons side, so I think that should be a piece of it. And the third piece of it, a part that we've been working on, is there are a lot of people who are reporters who cover stories, and they know not a whole lot about this subject. And I'm not talking about Wall from the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal. I'm talking about the beat reporter from this area or from my area in central New Jersey, who maybe knows what an atom is, maybe, and really doesn't know much about the story. We have to be able to try to establish rapport with those folks as well. So if we're going to do this seriously, I think you need a much broader agenda than just surveys. You really need to address the full set of issues that are going to influence policy and public perception.
Okay.
I'd just like to add another data point. Some years ago, I was on the Monitor Treatable Storage Review Commission, and we held hearings all around the country. And I don't know whether it helped an enormous amount, but I know one thing that happened. People would come up to us after and said, you know, the only group that will listen. So people come in, they ask us our advice, and it's clear they don't pay any attention at all to what we're saying, what we're saying. And you've listened, and you've made us feel like our message is being heard, and you're taking it.
account our questions, no matter how stupid they may appear from a technical point of view, but we need to, know some answers to these kinds of questions. And if you know that component, I think you're not going to succeed.
Thank you very much. I think we've got a good start. Now we'll open up the questions to the audience. Yes. Would you state your name, please?
Yes, my name is Kathleen Ferris, and I was here yesterday also from Murfreesboro, and I'm here as a layperson. I attended this assuming that the symposium was on nuclear waste, but most of what I've heard has been high-level waste. Furthermore, it seemed to me as I've listened to these presentations that the assumption is that the answer to global warming is nuclear power, and that this is going to involve new nuclear plants being built, therefore more nuclear waste being produced. And that this is going to mean that this is the future, and I've got some questions related to that. Am I right in my premise that you all see nuclear energy as the answer to global warming? Is that correct?
No.
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 Okay. Then, if we do go for nuclear energy, if that is the option that Dr. Parker suggested the public be able to decide on their own, if we do, how long will it take to build new facilities? These are some of my questions. Use of water for cooling. We're in a drought in the southeast, and yet TVA is talking about going nuclear. And so I'm wondering if these new facilities would require the same amount of water for cooling that the old ones do. But another question, more pertinent to the symposium perhaps, is what's going to happen to low-level waste? I have a friend whose son decommissioned I don't know if it's a reactor or something on the East Coast. He was the engineer in charge of it. And she's told me that he was told that where that material went was to be absolutely secret. And there is a great deal of low-level waste that already from the decommissioning of plants is going to places like Murfreesboro. And so my question is, have you given equal thought to the low-level waste and how it will be disposed of safely?
Who wants to take on the low-level waste question? Somebody may want to take on the reactor construction question. Go ahead.
I think the questions you raised are very serious ones, and obviously in the time we have available, we can't answer all those questions. Detail will be necessary. We need a whole separate symposium on low-level waste, which I think is deserved. We structured this particularly for the very long-lived material. What are we going to do in the distant future, in the far distant future? And the low-level waste in general doesn't fall in that category. And so that was therefore outside our purview, we did the discussion. But I'm very surprised that it is possible to send any material that is classified legally as low-level waste to any place except to a permitted facility. That's against the law, and they can be prosecuted for that. And the facility that they would send it to and do send it to is EnviroCare in Utah, and that's still accepting waste and will continue to accept the kind of waste that you're talking about from decommissioning facilities.
All right.
Who's that? No, Donald's going to stop in a couple of months.
It's still open.
So Donald's not in play. And I think I'd be happy to talk to you in more detail sometime. But the water question, I think you were somewhat misinformed. We at Vanderbilt wrote the textbook on thermal pollution, and all the EPA regulations require cooling towers now. They lose a very small amount of that water that's used for cooling that goes right back into the system. And if you take the TVA lakes in particular, you cannot tell by looking at any examination of the water in the TVA lakes, you cannot tell which lakes have power plants on, either nuclear or coal-fired power plants. The heat is distributed and dissipated so quickly that it has no impact except very, very locally, which leads to thriving fish populations because they like the water and people congregate there to fish without any ill effect.
Could I just ask about Browns Ferry, which was closed, I think, last summer because there was lack of water to cool it down?
The water actually got too hot. I believe, if I recollect, that there was an outlet temperature requirement, an inlet temperature requirement that got too warm. So it was the reason they temporarily shut.
That's part of EPA's regulation, and I think they know the fact that we have warm summers in the south. And particularly that we tend to exceed those temperatures, and I think Mark can answer that question.
Bob, do you have something to add to the...
No, it's exactly new.
Okay.
In the comments on review and evaluation of the repository, I'd like to comment, I think it's essential that one have an independent state review agency. I set up EEG in New Mexico for WIC and was the director for 22 years till I retired. At one point, when we got into some heavy political pressure, the two senators intervened to assign us to an educational institution of New Mexico Tech. And in that way, we were able to publish our reports, do our analyses without political pressure in getting that done. It's essential to have responsible state involvement. For example, the IRG, the Interagency Review Group, is cited earlier as a group to look at. Well, states were excluded from that group. There were only federal people involved. And in fact, in looking at the list of ethical considerations, I didn't see an overt mention of public accountability of funds. I don't have to remind anyone here that to date on the high-level waste program, we've spent $10 billion, and the main thing we have to show for it, the canceled checks. Okay, now, the question I have coming up is, we use DOSE as a presumptive index of the hazard of a repository, whether it's 15 or 25 milliliters. And this I wanted to direct to Dr. Upton. In 1957, when I was doing the measurements of fallout from the nuclear test site, the value that we used was 3,900 millirenkin per test series. Renkins are comparable to REM and then 83 yards of air, but roughly we have lowered the allowable annual exposure by a factor of 200. Now, when we tell people today that the figure of 15 millirem is going to be acceptable for not only 1,000 years, 10,000 years, Bob Lundin's points out, even for a million years, Dr. Upton, do you think we need a little more humility or being less sanguine about our confidence in that these numbers will not change?
Looking back, as you pointed out, we've seen them change. I see no reason why we should assume they can't change again. As a matter of fact, I think, as I tried to emphasize in my presentation, we're learning more and more about how radiation affects cells in a variety of ways, some favorable, some unfavorable. It's conceivable to me that the dose limits could go in either direction. It may well be revised in either direction depending on circumstances. I think, as you indicated, it's probably arrogant to assume these are locked now forever at the present level.
Questions? Yes.
Thank you. My name is Sam Turner. I have first a comment or a some observation. It's from a movie that there's a scene in it, the movie from the mid-1980s. I don't remember much else about the movie, so it must not have been that great, but I do remember the scene. And it's a little bit appropriate being here in a university. It's about a nuclear, an undergraduate student in nuclear physics, or the physics department. And he signed up to take a course in Shakespeare and literature. But he decided that, well, he wants to go to graduate school, so he can't afford to not get an A, a 4.0 grad, GPA across the board. So he goes to his advisor and says, well, I would like to drop this class. And his advisor says, well, no, here's what I'll do. I will guarantee that you get the A, because I want you to take a course in Shakespeare. I feel much more comfortable knowing that the future nuclear physicist will have had some training in the physics and not just in science. And I think that in two ways, that's shown here amongst the group of people that we have in front of us, from Dr. Parker, through David to Chuck Powers. We have economists and social scientists on this panel, and it seems to be a much broader spectrum of people than I anticipated when I came to this seminar. And the second point was that throughout this symposium, there's been a continual discussion on the idea of trust and building a trust between the various stakeholders in this discussion. And that was exactly, I believe, what this scene in this movie said to me, and it's what stuck with me for now, almost 20 years, I guess. And that the student's advisor wanted the trust that the people he was dealing with that would be doing these advanced technological things had some sense of the community that they were becoming. Now, my question, and my notes are a little messed on it, but this came up during Chuck's discussion presentation. How, since we are a nation of laws that are essentially bound by the political realities, do we get our way out of this box that he described that was ostensibly prescribed to us by these very politicians? And so we work in a world where the politics are a reality, and we have to work with the regulations and the laws that are given to us. And how do you see us getting beyond this particular state that we're at?
That's me.
It's Chuck, but it's actually David touched on that in his remarks. And in a sense, Frank, you also did. And I think that this may not be what you meant, but that the one answer is to really, in a sense, look to other groups who have been involved in essentially political action, working at a grassroots level of informing the public and seeing that they're both educated in the science and in the process and the need to make these kinds of decisions.
Well, the kind of politics that functioned to take the IRG recommendation for a two-stage process to allow both fund the potentially viable regionalized sites for the first repository, and then we're calling for a second set of examinations so that we're going to be anticipated to be much even broader regional. That got prescribed was through a process that is, if I understand it right, what it is that the populace in both Iowa and presumably again in New Hampshire today is saying that they want something really quite fundamentally different from, and they seem to be voted for people who think they're going to be able to do that quite differently. Now, whether or not they wind up being able to do that, I think there is the possibility at this point for a fundamentally new way of thinking about the relationship between politics, law, and ethics. It seems to me, and I think everybody who's been part of this has said one way or another said this, that the way in which the law is currently written won't get us anywhere toward what either David talked about or even Tom talked about today. And I think that there are going to be fundamental changes. And the question is, are they somehow going to be better guided by a process? You mentioned the issue of whether or not the IRG had as state participation. It itself did not. But part of what it defined is the imperative social consensus, which it said was essential to the next step in implementing what it is that they called for, would it involve not only a social consensus among the populace more generally, but also called for direct, much more direct state involvement. It was the federal agencies who had been called together to make that recommendation. I didn't say the IRG was perfect. I am suggesting that it's going to take stepping back and sort of saying, what kind of problem is it that we have, and is it possible to begin to try to better relate the ethical, legal, and political process? And hopefully what you don't have is a situation in which, you know, two senators say, I'm sorry, you can't be in my sight, so let's go for the weakest team. I didn't talk today about how Rawls would have felt about that, but I could have done the discussion of distributed justice and would have could have made that an impossible process. Can the country ever get to a place where its politicians don't, in fact, decide on a purely parochial basis? I'm not sure, but I have a feeling that part of what it's hearing from its populace is it better get a lot better at than we're doing so far.
Pam, since you addressed one part of the question to me, I just want to say very forcefully that I categorically reject the idea of informing or educating the public, because it has the connotations that we know the answers and we're going to tell them how it should be done. I believe very strongly we need to involve the public. They have to be partners in the process. But we don't know all the answers, and we wouldn't be sitting here 50 years after we started working on vitrification without having solved the problem. Two comments, one of which is I made a normative talk about what I would do if I was king, without any pretense at all of believing that anything that I was recommending might ever happen. I just want to be sure you understand that. Now, that said, and that's important because it's in the context of what I'm about to say. I have become a real pessimist myself about the ability of the Congress in the situation we're in now, and have been for the last decade, to do things that aren't highly parochial. I find it impossible to believe that almost any senators will vote to open up a second repository program if there's any possibility at all that it will end up in their state or somewhere near them. And I've seen that it seems to me so impossible that contemplating it sounds to me like, you knock your head against the wall, you come against the bug, as much used to say, and I just think that's just beyond us, and that's a terribly pessimistic view. But I believe in my bones. I just can't see that my senators in California would conceivably at all entertain political risk of voting for something in which it might end up in California. When we got this place here, which, for better or for worse, and you can finish the sentence. And so am I too pessimistic? I started life as an idealist, and I'm still an idealist, but I think the political realities have to do with that. So given that, what needs to be done is to cope with what we've got. But to open it up again seems to me to be beyond the political reality of today. Despite the hope I have that who I'm going to vote for, and I told you earlier, has at least some chance of starting anew in some other things. God willing. This, starting anew, I don't see it. If anybody else thinks that I'm too pessimistic, please tell me why.
Pause.
Yes.
Where's the microphone?
Yes, a few comments. First of all, I have to agree with what Frank said about involvement. That's a key issue in our program. And I would like to couple that to what was discussed before about the social economical aspects, because I was a little bit confused. If I understand correctly, I got the feeling that there is no really big part of the program that is socio-economical around that amount. In the Swedish program, since we started 15 years ago, that's an essential part of our program, the is the socio-economical part. And that's the main vehicle for involvement of the local people. Because that's an area where they feel concerned. That's an area where they can give advice. They will not advise us on the thickness of copper canisters or the type of copper to be used, but you know, the way you should implement the facilities, if the local industry can be part of that, what quality assurance procedures do they have to construct within their companies to do that, to be part of the implementation of the system and so on. So the socio-economical program is, I would say, the most forceful vehicle for involvement of the local population in our program. And we do studies by independent scientists on what would be the potential effect on land properties, on the cost of the land, and all these things that are near to the people. Actually, I would contest what has been said here, that people are most concerned about the long-term doses. They are not. Of course, they are concerned of what might happen to them, to their children, to their grandchildren, and a few, let's say, the nearest future in decades and maybe centuries. That's the key concern. Then, of course, they are interested also, can something happen after the next ice age? But that's not close to their heart. What is close to their heart, what will happen when these guys come here and start to build a repository? What will happen on the roads? What will happen? Can I keep the blueberries in the woods and all that? And to discuss that with them and to get their feed into the process, that creates the involvement according to our experience. So it's more a comment than but my question would be, is there or is there not a socio-economical program in the Yucca Mountain context? If it's not, I would strongly recommend to start.
Does anybody want to comment on that? Okay.
I just wanted to make a comment. I'm not as pessimistic as Bob is. You know, we have Yucca Mountain. I mean, we have it. It's open. You know, we're putting a lot of material in it, and I think we're doing what's right for the country there. We're moving forward at the cleanup of the nuclear weapons complex sites. We're putting stuff in glass. I don't know if you've been following the papers recently in Washington area, talking about Virginia looking at maybe mining uranium. You know, the state legislature there and looking at the concept of, well, there's some deposits there and re-looking at mining that in Virginia. You know, and so you start those kind of dialogues, you know, around the country. I think a lot of the topics that were talked about over the last 2 days are about, you know, a new beginning. You know, and I think, you know, we had kind of this pregnant pause after Tom got done talking. You know, I guess for the panel, you know, I'd like to hear a little bit of response to what Tom had said with regard to, you know, the potential path forwards and have a little bit of dialogue around it, because it kind of, you know, it seemed like we just accepted, you know, what he said as the truth, and that, you know, that quote-unquote we're out of touch with reality. And, you know, I think that not everything that was said is probably going to turn out to be right. You know, and I would like your views, but I encourage people to keep pushing. You know, it's like you worked on it for 50 years. Frank, you got enough. So my comment and question to the panel is, so what is your response to that?
Yeah, since he was inspired somewhat by David Cosman's excellent wrap-up remarks, I think Dave...
Actually, I think someone else should, because I think I spoke to how I felt about it. And also, I think that it's true that we've got to look into political aspects as well as technical aspects and social aspects. So in that respect, there is going to have to be a political process that would enable the processes that we're talking about. But to say that you're going to throw out everything, I don't believe it. I don't think that's appropriate. And I do believe that, going back with the statements I said at the very beginning, we have to recognize where we are and move forward in a pragmatic sense. We have to do things right, and we have to be able to think and evolve as we go forward.
A question back there, and then Mark.
So if anyone else on the panel want to comment on Mark, or respond to Mark.
I'm not sure, David, that I... You know, when I sat down to read Ernie Moniz and John Deutsch about what they thought of it after, and they did their little Washington Post op-ed piece about a year ago, and I sort of read through it, it looked as if they were sort of heading off in new directions, and I said, oh, then of course we're going to continue to try to license Sinayaka. I have a feeling that what I'm hearing from Roger and other people suggests that either we're going to fundamentally redefine what licensing at Yucca looks like, or we're going to start some other process that looks as if it's going to meet some of the other criteria related to both informed consent and distributional equity and that kind of thing. Or we're just going to bang our head again. Every, you know, for the last 15 years, we've been sort of saying, you know, we just have to keep on keeping on. And that seems to me that unless the public thinks that there's something fundamentally new going on, I don't think we're going to get much further than we are now. So I'm not saying that you toss the other overboard, but I do think that maybe we have to sort of come at this thing in a fundamentally different way. It may be the kind of articulation that Tom Isaacs gave yesterday of the key to national security issues, and sort of backing our way back into whether or not we need a repository. I do think that David was right in suggesting we probably are going to need to have some sort of non-repository option in the centralized form for a while. But that has to be put together in some such way that the public believes that what it thinks that Nevada has appropriately rejected because they got, you know, as Tom talked about or somebody talked about, they got screwed in the process. Even the same job that has to be done so that, in fact, you can get some fundamental new start on. So.
Make one brief comment to Mark's question in terms of the optimism on that. You know, we're talking about long-term waste. We're talking about this long period we've dealt with these issues, which is now 40, 50 years, if you will. We're talking about large-scale changes and adjustments to social phenomena, to culture, to the whole way we think about the world. And we're very impatient about things don't change as we or some others feel that they probably should change on an immediate basis. I also thinking about the problems that this society has on a long-term basis and the time we have to change on a long-term basis. Maybe the question of whether you're an optimist or a pessimist has to do with your time horizon. And I keep Chuck put it in a negative way, and I'll put it in a positive way when he was talking about keeping on, keeping on. Many, many years ago, I was, and mentioned this last night in another conversation, that I was intrigued by Faulkner, and I don't remember now exactly where it was, where he was describing the black experience in the areas that he knew so well. And he said, the sentence was, and they persevered. And persevering may be part of the issue here, because these are, you know, really serious, long-term kinds of issues in terms of where do we want the society to go, how do we want to handle the future, what kinds of future do we want to have, and how we're going to deal with what exists. And people change, cultures change, things adjust, and I think we need to persevere.
I don't want to say anything on this because I've already said too much, but I've been derelict. I thank all the participants for previously, but I did not thank all the people in the room who were helping the process here, and particularly thank Kevin Brown, please, Bradley, Laurie Parker, have a relevant plan. I'm a real optimist, but I'm not a short-term optimist. I'm a pretty much second repository idea as a way out of this. My optimism goes to some facts. I watched the debate in Las Vegas. Clinton said she believed that the repository wasn't safe. The other two, I'm talking about Obama and Edwards, one of them said that they had been told that the transportation could never be accomplished with safety. I can't remember which one. And another one said that they believe that the science had been seriously compromised and that it was just bad science. Now, I believe that all three of those opinions can be countered with some facts. Okay? Because the facts are otherwise quite separate from the value judgments one wants to make of the facts. And therefore, I'm an optimist. I just don't believe what my economy that the person I'm going to vote for is going to be President Biden, and I don't know which one of those three, but I'm going to vote for it. And then they're going to kill it. I just don't believe it. But that's not the issue. You're talking about some guys. As Chuck had said, I thought Russell's talk was particularly to the point. The longer-term dilemma we face isn't that. I mean, even if as I expect, the repository won't be killed. There'll be some slowing down, but it'll go ahead. Her bubble won't run. The fundamental issue that we have to deal with here is a societal investment in a huge process that has to be joined by intergenerational equity. And that process requires some leadership, intellectual leadership and political leadership that I'm hopeful for, but not sanguine about. And I think that's where the rubber hits the road here for the longer term. This has to do with political leadership. In the short term, I'm not as pessimistic about how it's going to come out next year when my candidate wins. But I don't know which one it's going to be, but I know it's going to be one of them. And in the intermediate term, the muddling through is going to be kind of totally unsatisfactory to be all that's left in the case. So what I'm looking for and what we heard some inspirational ideas about was things that could lead to a reevaluation of the longer term meaning 5 or 10 years, the political process, in which leadership can lead to a more enlightened political grappling with these issues. And on that, I'm optimistic because I believe the time is right for a reevaluation. Because the people that put the original policy in place are all gone. The U-Doll's gone, Bennett Johnson's gone. They're all gone. The only one left is Domenici, who we come to. So that means that there's the opportunity for revisiting by people who can think about this. I'm very optimistic.
Okay. What I'd like to do is get the two more questions up here, and Mark, and then I'd like to just offer a thought about one framework that might capture the essence of our 2 days of exciting discussion and presentation. So, yes.
Okay. My name is Barbara Toffler. I am an organizational psychologist. Though I did go to Woodrow Wilson in Shakespeare because I have an English literature major a long, long, long time ago. I sort of feel the need to give my credentials because I haven't been waving my hand yesterday and today. So I have a PhD from Yale and I was a Harvard Business School professor. So I've been around a little bit. But I am not a scientist. I am a social scientist. And I do want to speak, though we're going back a little bit, to the comment that Frank made about that we really can't educate or inform people because we don't know all the answers ourselves. And I understand that approach is a way of saying, we don't want to be so arrogant, like a colleague of mine at Harvard who said, we have to tell managers what they think. They don't know what they think. They need our advice. We don't want to be that way. But the fact is, I just heard the word facts used. The fact is that you do have to, whatever words you wish to use, whether it's educate, inform, teach, make knowledgeable, I don't know what phrase you want to use, I'm sorry, I'm not really asking a question, I'm making a speech, and I apologize. But it is really important that people know the facts and they have the education, because they don't know. And again, it doesn't necessarily have to be anything about fuel rods and 1%, blah, blah, blah. But they do need to know and understand the real facts about what it means to have some kind of a nuclear waste facility near where you live. We're talking about all the socioeconomic needs, but you can educate. It's not arrogance. It's arrogance not to educate, pardon me, but to help people. I happen to be married to Chuck Powers, just to throw in the reality. We live in a township in which we are very, very involved in the community, which has many different ethnic and religious groups. And one of the things we have discovered is how very, very effective it is to educate people, to do things like, let's have a government at a glance, TNET, government at a glance, and bring a community, a Muslim community, an African-American community, all of which are there, and just help them understand. We don't have an elected mayor. We don't have a mayor who makes decisions. They all thought the mayor did make decisions. I don't want to go on and on with this, but just facts can help people then say, gee, I hadn't really thought about that. So I would suggest, again, that you be not quite as modest, Frank, and say I do have something to educate people with, all of you, to help people understand so that they can truly make some informed decisions and work with you as you work with their communities to move nuclear waste and nuclear power, if that may be where we're going, to a place where it really is used successfully by the broader community. Thank you for letting me speak.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Any response? Yes, go ahead.
A Jukari. Words do make a difference. They give meaning to people who hear them. And the difference between educating people and getting them involved are two very different concepts in my mind. You get them involved, they participate, they help spawn the ideas. They need information to do that. I don't deny that at all. But just tell them, we're going to tell you exactly what's going on in this world. And what's real to us is not real. It's a value judgment. And what's real to us is not real to a lot of people. They look at it very differently. And if you talk to someone like Tom Cochran, who I very highly regard for, some of the things that we say are facts, he would dispute absolutely, because the judgments go into it. And it's those judgments, I think, really make an enormous difference. So I'm in favor of all of us getting as many people as we can involved into the system and having them learn about it as much as they care to learn, which is something I think, when you say you're going to educate them, some people don't want to learn, they don't want to be involved. That's their privilege as a democratic society. But for us to say that you will learn and we will tell you exactly what you need to learn and in the form you need to learn, it's just something that I do not believe in.
I look forward to sitting down and talking with you further.
Mark Peters, Argonne Monitor. It's been a fascinating 2 days. Unfortunately, I'm going to do another comment. Y'all might react, but I'm going to switch gears on you a little bit. I think we could have a third day, and I'd be willing to change my plan if you're willing to stay. Because we didn't talk about, and y'all, those who know me know that I'm sitting here thinking the whole time, what's the science and engineering we've got to go do to make all of this great stuff happen? We haven't, it's been implicit in some of the comments, but we haven't talked about that very much. And there's pockets of people in the department, for example, who are thinking about that. It's not integrated. That's the problem. So I think I would implore this group, us, to not forget about that this is a great opportunity to, I think, really rethink the way we do the science behind waste management and the fuel cycle. We talk about let's design an integrated fuel cycle. I say that all the time, too. That's not actually a straightforward technical problem. It's a great one. I can't wait to start diving into it, but it's got a lot of challenges. The science-based performance assessment approach. I think there's a lot to be said for going away from an empirical-based performance assessment and going to much more science-informed performance assessment. Things that John touched on in his remarks. So I didn't see that explicit. I would encourage us to not lose that in our recommendations. It requires a lot more discussion. But I really would like to see that called out so that we don't forget it, because I think there's also an opportunity within the bureaucracy to try to push that forward as well. And again, I apologize for the comment. I welcome reactions, but I would imagine we can probably agree with what I said.